I'm Ida Glaser. I'm the director of the new Center for Muslim Christian Studies in Houston and also the international academic coordinator for the Center for Muslim Christian Studies in Oxford, of which I used to be academic director and then director. I'm here today because I'm holding in my hands an amazing book. It's called Genesis 1 to 11, Bud of Theology, Grandmother of the Sciences, Seedbed of the Holy Books. And I have had the huge privilege of co-authoring this with Anwar al-Azad. And it's the very first commentary in a series of which I'm series editor.
Dr. Glaser, Ida, it's so good to see you. Thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel podcast.
Delighted to be with you.
You've been here at the library for a couple of days, and you've been studying, and hopefully it's been a productive time for you. We'd love for you to come back and be with us for a longer period of time.
I've managed to pretty much complete a chapter on what is the gospel, reflecting in Islamic context.
Now, you've been with us on a podcast before, and we're going to put in our show notes kind of a link to that because you tell a good bit of your personal story with that. Mm-hmm. And you told us in that podcast a bit about the Oxford Center that you've directed and now the Houston Center. Mm-hmm. Let's talk specifically today about this commentary series. It's a unique commentary series. There's nothing quite like it. So tell us a little bit, what is this series about? Because we have lots of commentaries in the library, but this is a very unique approach to commentary writing. Tell us about it.
Okay. Well, this is commentary from Muslim contexts. So as far as I know, there haven't been serious Bible commentaries that have tried to take a Muslim context into account since some that came out in Arabic in the 10th century. So that's like a thousand years.
Okay.
So you'll
find, a long time.
you'll find some of the Bible translators these days and one project in the Arabic-speaking world that are trying to produce Bibles that have annotations in that is suitable for Muslims, but not full serious Bible commentary.
And this is a part of a bigger project that you're working with, this book.
Yeah. So maybe if I can tell you how we came to do this.
Yeah, that's great.
So I myself had done my doctorate on reading Genesis 1 to 11 in an Islamic context. So putting it in conversation with the Quranic material, because there are parallel stories in the Quran. You get Quranic stories of creation, of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Enoch, Noah.
Mm. All the main players.
Yeah, yeah. And they play out into Islamic tradition as well. Did you know that Seth was a prophet in Islamic tradition?
I don't think I remember that, no.
So Muslims and Muslim background believers coming to Genesis 1 to 11 are going to have all that in their mind. And of course, the Quran functions like a commentary on the Bible in many ways. So it's like the Quran's versions, plural, of the Adam stories function like authoritative commentary on the Bible for Muslim readers. Mm. So Christians reading alongside Muslims and Muslim background believers have to take account of that as they read the Bible and as they teach it and preach it. Mm-hmm. Just like if you're a New Testament scholar sitting here in the States, you probably have to take some account of the critical scholarship.
Yes.
And of the popular scholarship, you know, Bart Ehrman and so on, mm-hmm. whether you want to call him critical, popular, or whatever.
Right, right. A little bit of both, probably.
Yes, your New Testament scholarship and teaching would be lacking if you took no account of that.
Exactly.
So similarly, in Islamic context, there's something really missing if you don't deliberately take account of your context. And of course, you are taking account of your context even if you don't think about it.
Yeah.
So
true.
I had this vision to produce some books, one on each book of the Bible, which would help people to think about how this scripture relates to Islamic teaching in an Islamic context. And I asked a very fine Lebanese scholar if he would help develop this with me. This is Martin Akkad, who's my co-series editor. So we decided that what we needed to do was to get together particularly some Muslim background believers from different countries and to ask them what they needed. Every single one of them said, we need full Bible commentaries, because every verse and every word of the Bible is relevant to our contexts, and we need to read every word of it properly within our contexts. Besides which, people have been telling us, look, the Western commentaries simply don't fit us. So I was talking to a woman in Uzbekistan, Muslim background believer, who has been searching for Bible commentaries to translate into Uzbek. And she can't find any that fit her context. Her context is so near to the world of the Bible that she doesn't want to have to drag her readers out into America or Britain or even into Russia.
Right.
In order to understand the Bible.
There needs to be a more direct link, doesn't there?
So we said to these Muslim background believers, none of us knows how to write commentaries. Even the well-known Old and New Testament scholars we had with us had not actually written commentaries. But we said, if that's what you need, we'll try to do it. The problem is, as we approached a publisher, which is Langham, said, well, this is a great idea, but can you find enough people to write these commentaries? And my answer was, that's the wrong question. Can we find any people to write these commentaries? And the answer is, maybe I could write one, but identifying even one person who would have the skills, the biblical skills, the knowledge of the Islamic context, Quranic studies, embedded in a cultural context, and with the pastoral skill to write an appropriate commentary and the writing skills.
Yes.
Exactly. Impossible.
Yeah. You're narrowing down.
Down to zero, really.
So what is the market for this? Is this going to be read by scholars primarily? Is it going to be for students who are studying in an Islamic context?
Okay. Well, the idea is that each of the commentaries is going to have a very specific primary readership. So this first commentary, the primary readership is the Muslim background believers in the theological college in which Brother Anwaril was teaching.
Who is your co-author?
My co-author, yes. So the writing team is him and me and his other teachers, and it's all been tested out on their students and so on. And we've also had...
So is that testing already taken place, or is it taking place now?
It's well taken place, because the original version is written in Bangla. And then it gets translated into what I call Banglish.
Banglish.
And then I work with it and send it back. And so we've worked in the two languages, so it's developed in Bangla and in English at the same time. And... in fact, the very first draft of it was written on the basis of the questions that Anwaril has been answering as he's been teaching these Muslim background believers Genesis 1 to 11 for a number of years.
But Anwaril, during this process, something happened to him. Tell us a little bit about that.
He completed, really, the final script in Bangla, and he sent me his draft preface. And then he got COVID and a massive stroke and died, just like that.
That's quite a blow to you and to his family and to the seminary.
Yeah, and to the whole movement in Bangladesh. He was a really key person, very bright, had seen many Muslims come to Christ in his area, had taught people, and he was one of these unusual people who could relate to all sorts of people.
It's a huge loss. Bangladesh is not a country we think a lot about, except in the United States, unfortunately. When there's a flood, when there's great poverty there, it comes to our attention yet again. But it's a huge country. Well, it's not very large, mm-hmm. but there's millions and millions of people there, right?
Yes. I should have looked up the number, but I think it's about 170 million, something like that.
So roughly half the population of the United States.
It's a lot of people, wonderful people.
So how many Christians are there? And do you have a sense of how many Christians are there? Because it's mainly Muslim population.
Yes. I'm afraid I don't know the numbers. There is a small traditional Christian community. So it roots in the work done by William Carey there. So that's quite an established Christian community, which mostly came from the Hindu background. Mm. And they use a Hindu-based version of Bangla. So you then have the majority Muslim community, which use what we call Muslim language Bengali, which has similar grammar and syntax, but the vocabulary comes over from Arabic and Persian and Urdu. Mm. So there are a lot of different words used, and especially religious language.
Well, communicating would be seem like a real challenge.
There is some challenge here. Yeah. And particularly if you're thinking of gospel communication. Mm-hmm. So just to give you one simple example, what word do you use for God? So the Muslims all use Allah, the one God who created the universe and spoke through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Jesus, and so on.
Yes.
The Hindus use Ishwar, which is a word for a deity and has in Bengali ears an implication that this is one of a huge number of deities. Mm-hmm. Now, for Carey translating the Bible for Hindus, of course, he uses the word Ishwar, which is used in the Christian community. It won't work in the Muslim community.
Because of the idea of plurality.
Yeah. It immediately sounds polygamy. It sounds like an idolatrous word.
That important and yet a clear way of that would be miscommunication or setting up barriers automatically.
Yeah. But then there are also very ordinary words like water or table, which would be different in the two language groups. So my husband estimates that when they did the translation of the Bible into Muslim language Bengali, they needed 3,000 different words in moving from the Hindu language into the Muslim language.
Now, was this
Muslim
the full
language.
Bible, or was this the full Bible?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit, because of time. I wish we had more time, but let's talk a little bit about some of the places where you think in Genesis 1 to 11, where reading it alongside other Muslim heritage believers pays off. What's some of the payoff for you as you think about this?
Well, if you read the Bible with any group of believers, you find them coming at it from different ways.
Yes.
And asking different questions and giving different insights. So a colleague of mine in the Arabic-speaking world says, if you can imagine the Bible or a book of the Bible like a field of grass, and the goats are going up and down and up and down one little part of this grass, eating it up and eating it up and eating it up until there's hardly any grass left, and they haven't even noticed the grass on the other side. And he says, the Western readings of the Bible are like those goats going up and down
and up and down.
You know, every scholar's trying to find something else to look at.
Right.
Whereas
there's
a huge amount of unmown grass on either side. So this gets us into some of the unmown grass.
It's a great image.
Anwarul, when he drafted this out, gave a huge amount of space to the location of the Garden of Eden. Where is it? What was it actually like? And people reading the first draft were saying, this just takes up too much space. Why does it matter? So in developing this idea, I came back and said, why does it matter? Well, it's an obvious answer in Islamic context. We want to get there.
Yes.
Now, what's the story there? Well, the Quran has the garden and the temptation story. But in almost every interpretation of the Quran, this garden is paradise. It's in heaven. And the very word paradise, Firdaus, is a Persian word for garden and describes the fourfold garden. I don't know if you come, you have them in America. We've got the Botanical Garden in Oxford is one of these. It's divided into four segments, and in the middle, it's got a fountain. And of course, on the Indian subcontinent or in the Middle East, there would be rivers flowing from that to water it. The Taj Mahal has one of those in front of it.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So these are all attempts to recreate paradise. Mm. And the idea is that from the Quran, that Adam and Eve were sent out of paradise down to the earth. But then, after their time of testing on the earth, what they want to do is to get back to the paradise. Mm-hmm. So as you're reading this in Genesis, if you're sitting reading as a Muslim or a Muslim background believer, or you're sitting reading together, people want to know, where was this?
Where really was this place?
What was this like?
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that this does within the reading of Genesis, it suddenly brings alive that description. You know, it's not just boring, you know, what was bdellium or whatever it is. This turns into a really zinging description of the paradise of God, which is sometimes described in the Quran as well. And there are similarities and there are differences. But as you read it, you more and more think, oh, I want to get back, I want to get back, I want to get... And then you read the story of how they lost it. They got sent outside. And the door was closed, and they could not get back. Now, the physical location on Earth seems to be where? Somewhere in about where's now Iraq.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, interestingly, is where the Muslim caliphs built a round city with four segments, surrounded by all sorts of canals that were irrigating it.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to build paradise there.
Was that in Baghdad itself?
Yes, that's the round city of Baghdad.
Exactly. That's what I've read, yes.
Yeah. And you know, it was completely destroyed by the Mongol invasion. But you have this actual history of the attempt to rebuild it, which is even described in terms of the Eden paradise in some of the Muslim histories.
Yes.
And it's a vivid illustration. We have lost paradise. Now, how does that open up what we mean by the fall? How does that help you to think about the fact that having lost the land, the Torah is going to take you right to the edge of the promised land and then stop? How does it read as you go on to Jesus coming and looking for fruit in the land?
Yeah.
How does it whet your appetite for the final vision of heaven and the rivers and the water of life? But also, one of the key things when you're talking with Muslim people is that they will generally tell you, we are not fallen and we do not need redeeming. And you can sit and argue about the doctrine of original sin and try to explain it, as Christians have been trying to explain it for decades. Even to each other.
Right.
But what more do you need to demonstrate that we're fallen than this incredible image that we've lost Eden? And then as you read, I mean, this takes you in so many different directions. But Genesis 1 to 11 arguably gives you an understanding of humanity and of the world, which is the basis of modern science. And this story about Eden and the loss of Eden is part of that. Because one of the things that happens in Eden is that Adam names the animals. Incidentally, in the Quran, God teaches Adam the names. So again, that's a really interesting discussion.
Yeah.
And it really alerts you to what is the significance that Adam is given the job of naming.
Yeah.
And we could discuss that. That's a really interesting theological thing. But in the scientific context, what happened in the early modern era was that people started to ask whether they could rebuild Eden by finding the Adamic names.
Really?
Yeah.
I've not heard that.
Did you not know that?
I didn't know that.
This is really interesting, David.
No.
You've really missed something.
I missed that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In the monasteries at that period, you would have the Bible alongside the bestiary.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to read the Book of God's works alongside the Book of God's words. And if you look in some of those bestiaries, you will find that they give the names of each animal in a whole number of languages, Chaldean, Hebrew. Why is that? Because they're searching for the pre-Adamic language, which they think will give them the authority, the naming power.
Wow. It sounds a bit magical, doesn't it? If we have the right words.
It sounds like that to you, but it didn't sound like
to them.
The power of language is something that some of the modern philosophers understand it.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe evangelical Christians don't, but...
No, it's powerful. There's no doubt.
Yeah. And, the power of the word is there from the beginning to end of the Bible. Mm-hmm. But as the Reformation began, people began to realize that, no, you could not go back to that language because we're fallen, and after Babel, the languages are confused, and you can't go back before Babel. On the other hand, if we are redeemed, the redeemed people of God being remade in the image of God can begin to name the animals and the plants and. So the very first catalogue from the Botanical Gardens in Oxford, which I think is the second oldest in Europe, it's a list of the names of the plants. And do you know what it's called? Adam in Eden.
Adam, oh wow.
Yes, and if you read the preface, it will tell you
that
this is what is going on. We're naming and categorizing these plants as Adam named in Eden.
Wow.
So,
fascinating stuff.
Within the Bible, within Genesis 1 to 11, one of the things that this focus on Eden does, it makes you recognize that you've got a chiastic form running between Genesis 2 and Genesis 4, which is centered on the loss of Eden because of the disobedience. Mm. And you can then begin to see there are deliberate parallels between Genesis 2 and Genesis 4. What's going on inside Eden and what's going on outside Eden. So that really opens up in a vivid new way what the results are of the fall.
Yeah.
So how is that for a small taster?
It's a mouthful, that's for sure. It's not just a small taste. But we're talking today to Ida Glaser, who is one of the authors of a new commentary series called Windows on the Text, Bible Commentaries from Muslim Context, Genesis 1 to 11, which is the seed of so much good. I want to hear more about this series one day. Dr. Glaser, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Stick around for a nugget of wisdom from Dr. Ida Glaser. Thanks to our Cracker Jack staff at the Lanier Library that help us produce this podcast, Janet Seifert, Kathy Capes, Jocelyn Solis. If you enjoyed the podcast, please share it with a friend. Rate us so that others can find us, please. Thank you. If you have questions or comments, you'd like just to be in touch, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Till next time, thanks for listening.
While differing widely in the little bits that we know, in our infinite ignorance, we are all equal.